hfcc.edu/BMQFG.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
I'm Margot Martindale, the host of Foreign Policy's I Spy. Real spy stories told by the people who were there. On today's show, Amaryllis Fox, an undercover agent whose job at the CIA was to cultivate arms dealers and prevent them from selling fissile material to terrorist groups.
I set about creating a fictional art consultancy, and these fictions become real very quickly.
And on the show, CIA agent Jonna Mendez is sent to a capital city in Asia to help steal the top-secret encryption machine. Mendez's job in the operation is to fashion disguises for the team.
The thing that saved the day was a can of Dr. Scholl's foot powder, and that's what I used to basically gray Tugboat's hair.
That in a moment.
Thank you.
Mark your calendars for Henry Ford College's Women's Recognition Luncheon. This virtual event takes place Friday, March 18th at noon. The theme for this year's luncheon is Hats Off, honoring the work that HFC women do supporting students who need assistance to be successful at school. Proceeds from the luncheon support students with emergency funding to meet basic needs so they can continue their education. For more information or to register, visit hfcc.edu.
This is I Spy, a show from Foreign Policy where spies tell their stories.
I said to him, you know, if one of these groups that you sell to were to detonate one of these devices, that would create such fear globally, and that environments of fear create more autocratic governments, not fewer. And, you know, he at some stage said, if only there was something I could do about it. And there was this very pregnant pause where I think he and I both knew that there was, and that this was going to be the moment that we would talk about it.
From Foreign Policy, welcome to I Spy, real-life spy stories told by the people who were there. Each week, we feature one former intelligence operative from somewhere around the world describing one operation. I'm Margot Martindale. On today's show, Amaryllis Fox, an undercover agent whose job at the CIA was to cultivate arms dealers and prevent them from selling fissile material to terrorist groups. Fox began her career after the attacks of September 11th, when the agency's biggest fear was the possibility that Al-Qaeda or other groups would obtain weapons of mass destruction. She was in her mid-20s when she struck up a relationship with a Hungarian arms dealer named Jakub. His ties to terrorist groups in Indonesia and elsewhere raised alarm bells at Langley. Fox has changed some of the details of her story to avoid exposing the agency's operatives and assets. She begins where undercover missions often begin, with the crafting of a cover story.
In order to get after the targets that I was working on, the typical cover story of working for the U.S. State Department rather than working for the intelligence community doesn't really get you much with terror groups. I mean, from their perspective, if you work for the U.S. government, you know, that's no bueno. The distinction between working for the State Department and working for the intelligence community is a nuance that doesn't particularly matter when you're trying to build a relationship with a courier or somebody else who has access to a terror group. And so in order to get close to those kinds of targets, you have to look for something that makes more sense, puts you next to the people you want to be next to, but also explains why you're there, as in my case, a 20-something-year-old white girl. And many of the parts of the Middle East that I was traveling in, that wasn't a typical profile. And so the guidance was, you know, really lean into that. Try to figure out something that explains why you're there, rather than having to kind of encourage people to look away from the fact that you have this very different profile. Turn into the skid, as it were. And my family has loved art for a long time and collected it. My sister studied art and had done a little stint working at Sotheby's. And it was something that we all had a lot of background in. And so to be able to lean into my family's interest in art and paint myself as, you know, something of a young, maybe even a little bit frivolous, 20-something-year-old girl who was making ends meet by working in the art world, explained why I would be in these far-flung parts of the Middle East where there was suddenly an emerging art scene. And so I set about creating a fictional art consultancy. And, you know, these fictions become real very quickly because you spend as much or more time doing your cover work than you do actually conducting operations in order to seem non-alerting to anyone who's watching you. So I moved to Shanghai as my first full deployment undercover as a clandestine service officer. My work was to be throughout the Middle East, and China was just a home base. And the agency had briefed us before we landed on the ground to assume that the hotel room we'd be staying in while we were looking for a house, and then eventually whatever house we moved into, would be wired for surveillance, audio, visual, the whole nine yards. And I was newly married at this point to a fellow officer, newly pregnant with my husband. The agency is pretty old-fashioned when it comes to co-deployments. So if you want to be out on the tip of the spear with anybody else, you better be married to them. And I remember really clearly lying in bed, suffering from jet lag just like anybody else, but also from this kind of gnawing feeling that the walls and the mirrors and the blinking light on the fire smoke detector in the ceiling are all watching me, are all lenses through which Beijing is keeping an eye on us. And the clock went 2 and 3 a.m. And my husband was asleep beside me. And even if he'd been awake, we wouldn't have been able to talk about this anxiety that we both certainly were feeling, but had to just play off our trip as ordinary art dealers. So I lay there in this bed watching the blinking light on the smoke detector in the ceiling and trying to count it like you would count sheep, trying to ease my nerves and fall asleep. And in the end, I couldn't, and I got out of bed and kind of padded into the bathroom. And I remember really distinctly hearing the guidance that Langley had given us in my head, and they had said, just pretend to be yourself. And they hadn't said it with any irony, but I was standing in this bathroom kind of realizing that when I asked myself, what would I do if I were really me? I didn't know the answer. It had been a while since I had really been me. And the layers upon layers of fiction that come into play when your friends, your family don't know what you do for a living, when your colleagues are on the other side of compartments that are designed to keep everybody's identity secure and information secure. It's a very lonely way to spend your 20s. And it's very easy in those many layers of fiction to lose track of who you really are underneath. You know, as a young married couple going about building an ordinary looking life, we were constantly aware that anything we said or did was being observed, and that our job was to make it look as though we didn't know we were being observed. So it was a little bit of a Truman Show meta kind of experience. And, you know, anybody will tell you when you ask for advice about how to make a young family work, you know, the advice is always communicate. And that's a bit tricky when you're in an environment where everything is being surveilled. Jakob was part of a large network of dealers that were all looking to hawk nuclear materials. And our job was really to assess which of them had access to actual technology. The vast majority of people who look to make money in this game either are fraudsters who don't have access to technology at all, or are trying to sell something that is long decrepit, that doesn't work, or requires access to some other piece of technology that they don't have. And so sorting out who actually had access to the kind of technology that could pose a threat if it changed hands was the first step. And Jakob appeared to be one of those from the information that we had from others in the network. And so we set about trying to set up a meeting, and ultimately did so by having a source who we worked with in another terror group vouch for us, so that there was a sense that this was an actual approach from people who might be serious prospective buyers. And that was how he agreed to our first meeting. The funny thing about Jakob is that before I ever saw him, I heard him. I heard him singing. and he was walking down a street in Lyon, in France. I could see him a few yards out ahead, but only from behind and in shadow. And so I could hear his voice before I could actually make out the features of his face. And he was singing this kind of Hungarian folk song. And it was that kind of folk song that makes you feel nostalgic, even if you're not Hungarian and you have no idea what the words are. And it was very beautiful and very wise, and it sounded almost ancient. And I was really surprised, because in the brief email correspondence that we'd had, he hadn't come across as any of those things. And then when I walked up and asked him for a light in order to approach him before he knew that it was me that he was talking to, I remember the lighter lighting up his face, and it was so startlingly incongruous with his voice. He is this kind of rectangular brute of a man, physically, and his voice had seemed so soulful and beautiful and nostalgic. So there was always, in all of our interactions, I was struck by that dichotomy. The building of rapport and then trust with a potential source is really the heart and soul of clandestine service work. And it can be incredibly challenging and ultimately incredibly beautiful, because really what you're doing is, at the outset, you know, finding some common ground, some common interest, some reason to meet again. And over that time, it becomes pretty apparent whether part of this person that you're getting to know is oriented toward the good fight. You know, however hidden it might be because of the circumstances that he or she finds themselves in, there is often, I'd venture to say almost always, some locked away compartment of this person that wants to do the right thing, that wants to leave a legacy on this planet of life rather than death, of building a better future for their community, for their family, often for their children. And so the relationship building period is really a search for that. And then once it's found, the cultivating of that part of them, enabling them to feel strong and safe enough to unlock it a little. And over the course of that time, it's important that you and the source sort of begin to slightly show a little ankle. You know, you're beginning to explain that, you know, you have friends in Washington or special channels to the government, and that, you know, in the right circumstance, if the right thing were on the line, if lives were at stake, you would be able to call on those friends or use those channels in order to help. And that peeling of the onion, peeling away layer upon layer, continues as the relationship builds, so that by the time you actually have a conversation around calling it what it is, saying, I have this ability to link between you and the U.S. government in order to prevent the most horrific attacks the Earth would have ever seen. What do you say? You know, that's not a question that you want to come out of the blue. So I had a teacher in training who used to say, it's like a marriage proposal. You know, when you pop the question to your hopefully future spouse, you kind of want them to already know it's coming. And you kind of already want to know that their answer is going to be yes, or ideally, what took you so long? And a recruitment pitch is very much the same way. I was several months pregnant when I finally made the approach to Jakob, and we'd had several meetings before this, many meetings, and he did not know I was pregnant, but it gave me a reason to fly to Thailand on a baby moon and to meet with him there. And it was really important that this go well because he had indicated that he had interest from the Southeast Asian Brothers, which is a euphemism for groups like Jamaat Islamiyah, which was the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Indonesia at the time, and other regional affiliates to that terror network. And these were not guys that you wanted having access to anything on his shopping list. You know, Jamaat Islamiyah had been responsible for the Bali nightclub bombing and many other attacks throughout Southeast Asia and had links to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the mastermind of 9/11. And so these were really high-level players in a very dark game, and it was really imperative that they not have access to this level of weaponry. And so even though I felt that a few more meetings could have been useful, it was important to go ahead and have that conversation in Thailand at that time. And I felt pretty sure that Jakob was ready. The hotel where we met was on the beach on a small island in Thailand. And it's always been important to me to ensure that the hotel rooms that I meet assets in are the kind with a separate bedroom and sitting room with a door that you can shut in between. Because especially as a female officer, it just helps to keep everything professional and make sure that you're not sending the wrong signal. And so I got there early after doing a brief surveillance detection route to ensure that it was the right kind of setup and went about plugging in my little water fountain, which is kind of a funny thing to take to meetings, but it provides really great sound masking because water flows differently every time. And so you're able to mask any conversation without the ability to later go back and patch it out the way they could with a television show, for example. And it's also a very nice, peaceful setting to have a meeting in. As I was waiting for him in the hotel room, I was incredibly nervous because of the stakes, but oddly calm and hopeful because of who I knew Jakob to be. Deep down, I had a very strong sense that Jakob wanted to be the better version of himself. For the most part, these people, despite making incredibly evil choices, have some ethical framework that they believe to be right, however warped it may be. And when you do a good, thorough, slow job of building a relationship with a potential asset in one of these groups or one of these networks, you get a sense of where those lines are and therefore which attacks would be on the wrong side of them. And it may be that 9 out of 10 attacks they would not help to prevent. But one particular kind of attack is egregious even to them. And often that's an attack that claims more Islamic lives than Western lives. Sometimes it's an attack that claims civilians or children, women. And a lot of it depends on their unique history, their religious views, the traumas they suffered during childhood, the beliefs of their parents, so many different things that go into building an individual human being, just as is the case with any of us. And so the reason that the development process takes so long, the relationship building takes so long, is that every case is different, and it's really important to know in advance which attacks a given asset will put everything on the line to help prevent. Jakob came to our hotel room meeting singing, as he always did. And I remember thinking, it's a shame he's going to have to stop doing that, because it's not really the best way to approach a clandestine meeting. But there was something very beautiful about his voice. He came in and kind of threw himself down with exhaustion and kind of disgruntled despair at the political leadership, both in Hungary and around the world, as was his habit. And we talked about that, about how the economy was crushing friends and family of his, and how he really thought that it was no better than the earlier communist regime that had taken his grandfather's life. And I remember knowing that this was it and that he was ready. And I said to him, you know, if one of these groups that you sell to were to detonate one of these devices, that would cause immense suffering for these friends and family that you're talking about. And he said, no, it wouldn't. You know, we're not engaged in this war. It wouldn't have any blowback for my people. And I slowly and gently pointed out that it would, that, you know, this kind of weapon of mass destruction anywhere in the world being detonated would create such fear globally, and that environments of fear create more autocratic governments, not fewer, and allow for more clampdowns like the one that had killed his grandfather, not fewer, and destroy economies, not build them up. And that the suffering he was experiencing would only be exacerbated by an increasingly fearful climate around the world. And, you know, he at some stage said, if only there was something I could do about it, you know. And there was this very pregnant pause where I think he and I both knew that there was, and that this was going to be the moment that we would talk about it. And I asked him, you know, if not us, who? If not now, when? Archimedes said, give us a lever and a place to stand and we can move the world. And we have that lever and we have that place to stand, and it's our job now to move the world in a safer direction, Jakob. And, you know, he was fearful, but we had built an immense amount of trust. And I remember him very distinctly saying, will I be safe? What do you want me to do? Do you work for CIA? And that's the moment that you say, yes, I work for CIA. And he said, so are you going to arrest me? And I said, no, you know, we're old friends, Jakob. We can do far better than that. You know, we can work together to change history, to prevent a catastrophic attack. And I think I saw yes in his eyes before he said it. There was a long pause, but we got there. And he ended up being immensely useful in preventing an attack that would have cost tremendous civilian casualty count. You know, I think often the movies show the more paramilitary aspects of CIA, but in my experience, that's not really what makes the agency special. What makes the agency special is that at its best, its job is to listen, to befriend, to build relationships with, to find common ground with our enemies in order to make those enemies friendly enough that the attacks they're planning or the attacks that they're facilitating don't go boom. And that takes a lot of trust on both sides. But when it works, it does more to preserve national security than any military strike ever could.
Amaryllis Fox served for a decade as a CIA undercover agent. She describes the experience in a new book called Life Undercover, Coming of Age in the CIA.
You've been listening to a radio special of I Spy, Foreign Policy's podcast featuring real-life stories from former intelligence operatives. We'll have another story in a minute. To hear all the episodes, check out the I Spy podcast. Season 2 will be launching this spring.
Jumper, the one that came out of Louisiana on the back of a Trailways bus. I have a show called Cruising and Bluesing in the Nighttime right here on WHFR 89.3, 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. each and every Wednesday night.
Spy, a show from Foreign Policy, where spies tell their stories.
Next on the show, CIA agent Jonna Mendez is sent to a capital city in Asia to help steal a top-secret encryption machine from a Soviet embassy. Mendez's job in the operation is to fashion disguises for her team. She would go on to become the chief of disguise at the CIA's Office of Technical Service. The year was 1987, the early period of perestroika, the year President Reagan challenged Mikhail Gorbachev to tear down the Berlin Wall. Jonna is still not allowed to name the capital where the mission took place. She describes it simply as a city on the Asian subcontinent. And that's where she first meets her team members.
So this team came in, and their task was to go in and get that machine. I didn't know these team members. I'd never met them. I didn't know their names. I didn't even know the name of the team itself. My first encounter with them was on a road that I was told to be on. They came rolling up in a Range Rover. There was a parole. A parole is a back and forth. You know, where is the, I think it was an Oberoi Hotel. And my response was, oh, it's across the valley. Let me show you the way. And I climb in this car. And there are three men in the car who I'd never met. And off we went. And I asked them somewhat naively where we were going. And they said, oh, we're going to drive by the jail. And I said, why? Why would you do that? They said, so that if we're arrested and they put us in the jail and we can break out, we'll know which way to run. And I said, okay. And that was my introduction to the team. One of the first things we did was we figured out that we had to get the Soviets out of the compound so that we could make an entry. And so we worked with the ambassador to put together an invitation to a tiger hunt. they couldn't turn down a tiger hunt because they were rare. We thought they would go to that, and so that would give us a window. This is a very small compound, and it was a very small group of people that ran it. I think there were maybe three people. So we said, okay, so we will get the invitation put together and we'll pick the date and the time. Then we need to deliver the invitation. And while we're delivering it, we can be scouting out the inside of their compound because this was all behind a wall. And so my boss said, okay, we're going to take apart this car seat in one of the local cars. And it had a back headrest, and we're going to take the headrest out, and we're going to put a camera in the headrest, put it back in. Camera's going to be pointing out. And so if we drive into that compound, park, and then turn and make a full circle as we go out, we will have a 360-degree view of the buildings, of the doors, of the parking, of the security. So that was our plan. We had a local asset there that we had developed. We called him Tugboat. And we knew that he was agreeable to working with the West. He was agreeable to helping us within certain parameters. He would do some things. In order to do that, he would have to be disguised because this was not a huge city. And he was well enough known as this fairly senior police officer that we had to disguise him. So what I had to deal with when I saw this man for the first time, he stepped out of the shadows in an area where there was a large temple. And I just looked at him and I thought, I'm in trouble here, because he had a particular birthmark on his face that was so distinctive that anyone who knew him, anyone who saw that, would know it was him. So I was talking to an officer working in that city. And I said, you know, there's an issue here because I didn't bring any disguise. I have nothing. I had been told that this was a photography operation for me, that it was my photo skills they were looking for. And I've done enormous photography inside the CIA with proprietary cameras, with large format cameras, with sub-miniature cameras that we would put in a fountain pen or a lipstick. And I got there and discovered that this was a disguise job. And so I had to start from scratch. I told the local case officer who met me, I asked him to talk to all the wives of the station officers and have them all pool any kind of makeup they had and just send it in to me for one day. I promised to get it back to them. Then I went into the station and went through all the disguise kits, because every case officer out there did have a disguise kit that my office had issued. And I put all of that material together to see what I could extract, what I could work with. It was not ideal at all. But the next day, when all of those materials were assembled in a kind of professional manner with clean towels and big mirrors, and it looked like I perhaps knew what I was doing, and maybe even I had brought this stuff from Washington, D.C., just for him. The thing that saved the day was a can of Dr. Scholl's foot powder, and that's what I used to basically gray this. He was perhaps in his 30s, gray Tugboat's hair, to the point where the hair made him look like he might be in his 60s. That was the foundation for the disguise. I gave him a silver tooth. That was from some material in one of those kits. He had a widow's peak now. A pair of glasses. He was difficult to recognize. I just turned him into a much older man. The next thing we did, we made him a new ID card, taking his picture in his new disguise. We needed a government stamp. And he said, he said, I know where to get that. In the post office, I can get one of those purple government stamps. I'll steal one. We said, no, don't do anything like that. We got the stamp ourselves. We ended up taking that new ID card and we scoured it on the floor, scratched it, scuffed it, made it look all old and dirty. So we had a disguised man, and we had his new ID card, which looked very old, authenticating him as this new individual. Tugboat went into the compound to do just a very superficial kind of checking the locks on his own. And he did what we called lock impressioning. If you can get up to the lock, the outside of the lock, it's a way to make an impression of what the key should look like. We have people that do locks and picks, it's called. It's a little office of this Office of Technical Service. Their job is to go through security perimeters, everything, anything. After that episode, we had keys to the exterior doors. I entered the CIA in the late 60s. I started out as a secretary. Then I became the top secretary in this Office of Technical Service with no headroom, with no career advancement. And my boss said, what if you took some of our courses? Because this Office of Technical Service, we could teach you everything about photography. We could teach you everything about secret writing, everything about audio devices. It just endless. We trained people. He said, why don't you take some of our photo courses? And it was the next week. I went to this landing strip south of D.C., and there was a little twin-engine plane. They took the doors off the back. This was a very small plane. There was a harness hanging in there for one person. That was me. There was a headset. And there was a 35-millimeter film camera with a 1,000-millimeter lens. And that lens was probably a foot long. And so we flew around for a day, down low over the Chesapeake Bay. We were breaking all kinds of laws. I was trying to shoot radar arrays and license plates of particular cars. And then that night, there was a dark room in this facility, and they turned on the safe lights, and they played big band music, and I'm developing all my film, and I said, okay, I'll stay. This will be the first day of my career at CIA. Our office was very often referred to as Q or as Mission Impossible. The equipment that we fielded in our technical office was equipment that we had built ourselves. There was no commercial equivalent to what we needed, and so we would invent it. Our case officers used to listen to, Mission Impossible or Get Smart or some of the kind of fun pop culture spy shows on TV. We had a duty officer at the weekend to field the calls that would come in. Case officers would say, I just saw this on Mission Impossible. Can we do that? Can we make one of those? Do we have one of those? And, you know, most of them we kind of swept aside. But every now and then we'd hear a really good idea and we'd set off to invent it. Every piece of gear that we invented and fielded had a shelf life. Once you start using it, it is inevitably it's going to be compromised. And when it is, countermeasures are developed and the thing is dead. It doesn't work anymore. You have to start over. So we treated it like treasure. We treated that technology. It was treasure. We were very careful with who we gave it to. We made sure that they really needed it. We went through this requirement definition exercise, almost like the military would approach it. Do you really understand what you're doing and what you need? And then we'll build it.
You're listening to iSpy, a production of Foreign Policy. We'll be right back.
Henry Ford College is awarding about 300 scholarships worth more than $300,000 for the 2022-23 school year. To be eligible, you must be enrolled at HFC for 6 credits or more and should fill out your FAFSA form. Scholarships can help pay for your education and do not have to be repaid. The deadline to complete the application is March 31st. For more information, email scholarships@hfcc.edu or visit hfcc.edu and search scholarships.
This is a radio special of Foreign Policy's podcast, I Spy. You can hear all the episodes on your podcast app. We return now to Jonna Mendez and her CIA team as they try to steal an encryption machine from a Soviet embassy.
Well, the entry team in the van, the four gentlemen in the back with me, seemed fairly, I would not say they were relaxed, I would say they were ready. So there's a little nervous energy. If the nervous energy isn't there, you would probably start worrying. There should be an edge to what they were getting ready to do. The people in the front of the van, that would be Cooper, who was driving. He was cool as a cucumber through this whole thing. He was the boss. He knew this whole scenario inside out. He had written this scenario. He was feeling good. Probably the nervous person would have been our local agent, Tugboat. He was in the passenger seat. He had more on the line than almost anybody, because this was his country, this was his city, this was his community. This is where his family lived. He was getting ready to take a big chance, actually. When we set out in the van to go to the target, it was a hot day. It was a humid day. The van was not air-conditioned. I had actually asked if it was air-conditioned, and I got a very condescending look, like, you know, we don't need no air-conditioning, lady. And because we were wearing masks, they didn't breathe very well. While the masks looked really good, you could just sweat profusely inside of one of those masks in this kind of air. That was one of my concerns. But a team leader told me that they were tough guys and they could handle a little humidity and a little heat. What we were using was the initial technology that was presented to us out in Hollywood. And it was no more or less than the basic stunt double masks that Hollywood had used for years. We had the capability to make 3 different sizes. We had large, we had medium, we had small. The large, I remember, was Rex Harrison's face. The other two, I'm not so sure anymore, but they were movie star faces. So you can paint them, apply hair goods, beards, mustaches, or not, and you can make them any ethnicity that you want, any skin tone that you want. So while it might have started out Rex Harrison, it probably didn't end up looking a lot like Rex Harrison. We were also wearing gloves. We would paint them with veins and moles and fingernails, and they were very realistic. When they put on their disguises, they looked just like everybody else on the street. They just blended in. I not only disguised Tugboat, but I made him new documents, and he presented himself to the gate guard as a local policeman and said they were doing a series of security checks on foreign embassies. So they would be coming in. They would be inspecting all the locks on the building. They would be going through the compound to make sure that everything was in order. That was his cover story. The guard at the gate could have been a little suspicious of that story, but when Tugboat pulled out a big wad of money and said, "And this is for your inconvenience," I think when the guard took that money, I don't think he cared whether it was a real excuse or a made-up excuse. That guard saw his future. He had enough money that he would be able to leave that job and leave that town with his family and probably go buy a herd of goats and a new house and relax. We went through the first gate. Everything was precisely planned. The Soviets were sent on a wild goose chase disguised as a tiger hunt. I mean, you should never leave a place unguarded. Bad tradecraft on their part, but there was no one home. You know, in the van was a wooden crate. It was unmarked. It was built just to hold this piece of equipment. And they knew what the piece of equipment would look like. They knew how big, how deep, how wide. So they backed the van up to the building. They unloaded the crate into the building. Then they moved the van around to the side where it couldn't be seen from the street. All four of the guys jumped out and went inside. Two of them started going up the stairs. The other two put down ropes and pieces of equipment, came back out, got the box, the crate, took the crate in and positioned it. This was a winding staircase, and they positioned it right underneath that staircase. As it turned out, they were going to lower the machine into that crate on a rope. And the things that they took in, it looked to me like a tripod with legs that were in sections. They had gotten some blueprints from Tugboat. They had drawings of the interior of that building. And they were very confident in that they knew that the situation they would find this machine in, that they knew the parameters of how it would be protected. They thought they might even know the code to open the lock. But they took in with them a gadget that we called plasma. And plasma was a way to go through a steel door with a very, very specific charge at a very specific place and break the lock. And I heard two low thumps that kind of quivered the building. And I thought, that's plasma. The numbers didn't work. They brought out the machine. I was downstairs in the lobby looking up the whole time. But I saw them starting to lower this device in that winch-like contraption that was operating somewhat like a crane. It was taking the weight of the device and spreading it out three ways. The machine itself was disappointing. You know, you think something that is so pivotal to every embassy in the world, every nationality has a communications capability. It's almost always encrypted. It's high-end communications. This looked like it might be held together with a little bit of chewing gum and, you know, wire. It was not a refined piece of machinery to look at. It almost looked handmade, but it was important. They were lowering it. And one of those legs started giving away, and one of the men reached out and grabbed it and resecured it, gently put it in the box. Two guys still upstairs started taking that thing apart, put it back in the quivers. They were down the stairs. They were wearing special shoes with special soles. They were wearing gloves. So there were no footprints. There were no fingerprints. There was no slippage when you're going up and down these stairs. It was like choreography. It was kind of pretty. It was called a smoking bolt operation. A smoking bolt operation in that all that was left when we were gone were the bolts in the floor. While this was all going on, a local man came to the gate, and Tugboat was called over to the gate, and there was a conversation. The man outside the gate wanted to come in and see someone. The man inside, our man, said that person wasn't there. He's going to have to come back. When all of this was said and done, we could not guarantee that Tugboat had not been somehow identified or couldn't be identified in the future. We felt very uneasy about his safety when this was all done. And so we ended up, when the operation was over, when everybody was away, when the dust settled, we relocated him out of the country with his family. Cooper and I drove out of the embassy. Two of the guys drove out with us. Two of the guys chose to go over the wall. There was a place in the back of the compound where you could very easily just almost step over the wall and drop down to the sidewalk. And they thought splitting up, they felt good about doing that. There was a rendezvous point somewhere. Cooper and I drove the van to a garage, which is where Cooper had picked it up. It was a garage where you could actually, you had light and you could take things apart. So the van went back to the garage where Cooper got it from. And we had to do a little work on it. We painted it a different color. It was a temporary paint. It wasn't going to last. There were some markings that were put on it, the van. There were some license plates that were put on the van. The box, we disguised the box. We stenciled the box in a way that made it look like it had come into the country and it was good to go out of the country. And that involved some border stamps that all equipment that came into that country would receive. I believe that it went out of the country very quickly. Just like it came in very quickly. They didn't want that machine lying around anywhere. That was truly precious cargo. And it was driven out. I think the same man that drove it in drove it out. I heard later that there was quite a flurry of activity. They freaked out when they came back and said, oh, my God. I think they were very complacent. It was a comfortable place to be. They made an error when they all accepted that invitation. I was back at Langley for a conference. I was having a drink with one of my bosses. And he said, tell me about that operation. And I said, I really can't. You're not on the, it's called a bigot list. You're not on the list. I can't tell you about the operation. So I get this look. And he said, well, how about I tell you about this operation? His understanding of it was quite different from mine, that what we were doing was a ruse, that it was a show. It was a show to our enemy that we needed that machine. We needed it so badly that we would go in and grab it like that. A smoking bolt operation. That's how badly we needed it. He said, but we don't need that machine at all. Because there's another guy someplace else in the world who provides us all of that information, and they're breathing down his neck. So the reason we're taking this machine is to take the pressure off of that guy. They're going to say, if they needed that machine so badly, then we must be wrong about our suspicions about this other guy. And that's the old smoke and mirrors, the games within games, the circles within circles, and you can get a little lost sometimes.
Jonna Mendez is the former chief of disguise at the CIA's Office of Technical Service. Her latest book is The Moscow Rules, The Secret CIA Tactics That Helped America Win the Cold War. I Spy is a production of Foreign Policy. Our executive editor is Dan Efron. Rob Sachs and Amy McKinnon helped produce today's show. The interview with Mendez was conducted by Sarah Wildman and Dan Efron. If you have tips or suggestions, please write to us, ispy@foreignpolicy.com. If you like the show, please subscribe on your favorite platform and leave us a review. Foreign Policy subscribers can go to our website to hear bonus episodes of iSpy with additional excerpts and interviews. If you're not a subscriber, go to foreignpolicy.com/subscribe for access to all of the magazine's great content. I'm Margot Martindale.
Mark your calendars for Henry Ford College's Women's Recognition Luncheon. This virtual event takes place Friday, March 18th at noon. The theme for this year's luncheon is Hats Off, honoring the work that HFC women do supporting students who need assistance to be successful at school. Proceeds from the luncheon support students with emergency funding to meet basic needs so they can continue their education. For more information or to register, visit hfcc.edu.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported non-commercial radio.
That's where my baby stays.